Welcome to the Remote First Podcast. Every week we invite guests from large or innovative companies to share their insights on enabling an equitable and distributed workplace experience. I'm your host, Daphne Laforêt. Hey everyone, today I am with Dominic Price, who is the work futurist at Atlassian. So thank you for joining them.
No worries, looking forward to the conversation.
Me too. Actually, I'm really interested to first kickstart it with your title. I know that many people are like, you know, saying, what does that mean, work futurist? So can you just tell me a bit more? Because it's just such a cool title that I would love to have myself in a company. So please tell me more about that.
Let me give you the honest answer, because I think it's always important to start these conversations with brutal truth. So first of all, it's a made-up title. So I've been with Atlassian for around 8 years, and 4 years of that was running program management. So I was helping how we build our products and services, how we run projects, and it's a lot of it was around execution. And when we were doing that, we had this conversation one day where my boss was like, Dom, half of what we need to do is plan for the future. We need to be making things that our teams don't even realize they need yet. And that was the part of the job I really enjoyed. And so we started talking about that a little bit more externally. And actually one of our co-founders, Scott Farquhar, said to me one day, I love this new job you're doing, and you can call yourself whatever you want as long as you don't call yourself a work futurist. And a few of us were like, let's just see how that flies. And it actually got printed in one article. They were like, work futurist. And so one journalist wrote a story. And we're like, it kind of stuck. And the weird thing was, you know, Daphne, for like 2.5 of those years, it was genuine work futurism, as in what might be in the future. And then in March last year, it went from work futurism to like work nowism. Like, what is modern work and how do we make these changes? Because instead of thinking 3 or 5 years out, everyone was like, what do I do this week to engage my people, to build equity, to build inclusion, to get our people more engaged? It became very now focused, which I've enjoyed. It's been a little bit exhausting, but I think the modern work and the ability for us to talk meaningfully like we're going to do now around how do you build thriving workplace, that's a conversation we should have been having for years, and I'm glad we're having it right now.
Mm-hmm. It's no longer about like robots is going to take over the world and you know, AI is the future of work or things like that. People are realizing that right now with the era that we're living in, how the work is changing and everything, there's a lot of things to change in the way we're working, and this is what we should be focusing on.
100%.
Yeah. And then so at Atlassian, you're working on basically how teams are working and then basically trying to predict what are the next things that you would need to be built for Atlassian, basically.
Yeah. So my roles, not only is it made up, it's exceptionally strange, right? So the strange part is we've got one part which is internally focused. So if you think about Atlassian, like just to give you some stats, right, because this will help make sense. We hired over 25% of our workforce in the first year of the pandemic. So from March last year to March this year, 25% of our workforce never been in an Atlassian office. And so when you're signing up for that kind of thing, you're like, how do we do hiring remotely? How do we do onboarding? How do we get people integrated? So about half my role is internally focused, right? The how might we sort of question or conversation. To keep it interesting, the other half of my role is externally focused. So I take what we learn internally and I try and apply it to our customers, right? Whether they be small, medium, or large, or you know, some of the more, as I like to call them, heritage businesses. You know, I know that you deal in it with a global audience, but a lot of our customers are 150, 200 years old, right? Change and transformation for them is very different than a lot of the startups I work with who are brand new, who haven't got predefined views of the future of work. And so that half that's externally focused enables us to say, let's not create stuff that's unique to Atlassian. Let's use Atlassian as the test bed, right? As the place where we can experiment. And then let's use those experiments to help our customers. Because our mission is about unleashing the potential of teams. And we want to do that for ourselves and for our customers. And so it's always fascinating whenever I land on what I think is a new way of working or a new ritual or habit that works with Atlassian, going, I'm now going to go and try this with a 200-year-old bank, right, or a 150-year-old telco or a government agency or government institution, and try and adapt it to their environment. And that's the bit where we get to see the pragmatic future of work, which is very different to what me and you know as the theoretical future of work. The theoretical future of work's easy. Anyone could talk about that. The pragmatic one, like taking those rituals and turning them into action, that's a lot harder. And that's why I enjoy that external aspect as well.
We've seen I've seen a lot of companies like yours talking about, so many organizations, banks, and really like kind of
more boring, I would say, field that we're not used to, going digital, starting to think about, okay, how do I make my company a technology company? How do I make my workplace more digital first, remote first, because I want to hire another place? And it's crazy because this, you would never think you would have this conversation before this year.
And I think, you know, if I'm honest, that conversation was starting to happen in pockets, but it was happening slowly. There wasn't that sense of urgency. And so for me, I was seeing those trends occurring, certainly with the senior leaders I was talking to around the world. Those conversations were starting to happen. What changed in March last year is we poured accelerant on those conversations. We went from those conversations being a nice to have to going, we have to have this chat right now. Like, instead of saying, it might be nice for some of our workforce to maybe have flexibility, it became, I've just sent 100% of my workforce to work remotely. How do I now do that? I'm doing it. How do I do it well? And so the conversation changed. I think we're now in a different inflection point. Around the world, is some people are going back to the physical office, others are staying remote, and we've got this weird kind of what's next? Like, we've gone through this forced experiment with a ridiculous amount of constraints. Let's be honest, the constraints of the last year and a half, let's just hope that they don't stay for the next year and a half and after that. But we still have to design this new normal on purpose. I think there's a risk, and you probably know this through the people you've spoken to, we could design this new normal by accident, just by letting it happen. And I think that's dangerous versus saying, what are the attributes of this new world that we want to do on purpose? And how do we make this better than what we had before?
Mm-hmm. I mean, even as someone who did remote work before all this happened, I was already talking about isolation, lack of awareness that remote work can happen. Like, there was already a lot of challenges that we had to tackle at that time, that now is kind of going a bit like epidemic or not.
They've all amplified.
You know? Yeah. And so it's like, how do we do that now? If any people are going to be a bit more isolated or working in different locations and not necessarily having the back and forth that you would have in an office, or not being aware of their teammates, their reality and things like that, or how they're doing in one day working, for example, you don't see how people are doing their day. So how do you handle that? And then if everybody works like that, you're right that it might end up being, if you just let it happen, it could be quite painful.
No, not only painful, I think if we let it happen, we'll take a hold of design philosophies that works for co-location that we know won't work in the distributed world, but we'll keep them. And the challenge here is we've almost got to have like a funeral or a wake or a celebration for the past. Right? Like, what used to happen? Like, let's reminisce about 2019 and 2018 and how fun it was to be in offices together. Let's do that and then go, right, that's not going to happen again. Right? So now let's have the celebration for it. And it was amazing. And those things were all good fun. Now that's not going to happen again. What is the new dynamic around flexible work or the hybrid nature of where you work or distributed teams? And what does that mean for those different personas? And how do we build a set of environments where people get to do the best work of their life? And that's going to be quite different, but it's going to take a lot of unlearning those old habits and rituals. And I think for those kind of heritage or traditional businesses that we talk about, I think I have to be deadly honest, it's a lot harder for them. If you've got 170 years of history, that's a lot of history to forget to try a new way of working. For Atlassian, we're a baby in comparison. And for us, change is regular, change is constant. We're always changing. So you're like, So it's been normalized for us, therefore it's easier for us. And so I think what's going to happen is for those senior leaders in those organizations, that the power of adaptability, the power of empathy and vulnerability and actually sort of being genuine and authentic, they're all going to rise to the top. But for a lot of those leaders, that hasn't been their normal for the last few years. And so I think we need not only awareness of that change, but we need to help those people with that change and then be patient with them. Like, there is a lot of unlearning to do before we can discover this hopefully better way of working.
I mean, at Atlassian elsewhere as well, at Atlassian, you are a product kind of doing that way of working. The product is made, the suite is made for that. And you are basically eating your own dog food by applying. So this is basically like the whole blog, everything that, you know, I've been following Atlassian for a long time. And I think these are kind of the product that many remote companies have been using for a long time as well. Not trying to sell anything there, but you know, I just, it's a product, I think, that is kind of made for remote work. So for you, it makes sense. But then for a company that was always in paper or having the face-to-face and everything, it's very difficult to do that change. And they were very shocked by trying to say, okay, do I need a printer at home? Do I need to do all these things? You know,
and that's the thing. You take the norms of the office and you try and replicate them, which is human nature. You're like, here's what the office was like. I'll rebuild that same environment at home. And it's not sustainable or scalable. Interestingly, though, and I think there's a point that's not often realized by people. So we acquired Trello like 4 or 5 years ago, right? Trello at the time were built in a remote fashion. Michael Pryor, the CEO there, had built them as a distributed team. Around 20-25% of the people were based in a physical office in New York, and about the other 75% were spread across various areas with a good time overlap and sync. What was interesting was when we acquired Trello, Atlassian, we thought we were good at remote work, right? As every company thought they were. When we acquired Trello, we were like, oh, wow, we are like average at this. Like, they're amazing, which is bizarre because normally when a big company acquires a small one, you think you're going to tell them how to work. But we went and spoke to the folks in Trello, to Michael Pryor and his team. We're like, how do you do this? Like, what are the principles? And it was such obvious stuff when they explained it that seemed foreign to us at the time, right? So one of their principles was, If you're on a meeting, if one person is dialed in remotely, everyone dials in remotely. And I was like, no. Like, we'll all gather in a conference room and that person's on a screen. He's like, no, that's not a level playing field. That's not equity. And I was like, ah. And he said, so if one person dials in, everyone should dial in, then you're all on the same level playing field. And I was like, that's absolute genius. I've never done that. I hadn't ever done that. And so 3 years ago, in all the leadership teams that I'm a part of, we implemented that very simple rule. And so in Sydney, on one of the leadership teams I'm part of, there was 5 of us in Sydney and 2 people in the US. The minute they dialed in remotely, the 5 of us in Sydney would scatter to different parts of the office and dial in on our laptops. And I remember someone saying, it seems really inefficient. And I was like, it might be, but it's really effective. Because instead of me having to go, oh, Daphne's at home, so how should I act differently to engage with Daphne? Because she's, you know, through a different medium than me, we were all on a level playing field. And what happened was, not only did we then build the muscle of being better, you know, working in distributed teams and stuff, but when the pandemic hit, nothing changed. That leadership team ran exactly the same way from March last year to how it's running now. And so there was this beauty in going, oh, we were already doing that. Like, there were so many things we already were doing. That said, there were so many facets of Atlassian life around the rich tapestry of what we did together in person that I know we've sorely missed in the last year and a half. And so we've been working to say, in this time, when we can't get back to an office, it's not humanly safe to, how do we substitute that stuff? How do we do purposeful collaboration? How do we do that both synchronously and asynchronously to do it in an inclusive manner? And so we've been experimenting a lot. And I think what I always like to share with people is we haven't got the answers. Like, if anyone asks me for another best practice on hybrid work, I'm just going to give them a big hug and let them know it doesn't exist. Like, it's not that, like, there isn't a manual that tells you how to run a hybrid organization that for 200 years was in person. It doesn't exist. And so the way to achieve that is to experiment and explore and try things. But that takes a vulnerability that most leaders in large organizations aren't equipped with. So we're quite fortunate. We're happy to experiment. I'm not seeing that en masse across organizations. They're almost looking for the answer or the silver bullet. And I think it's beholden on us as leaders to say, I'm going to try something. And if it works, I'll do more of it. And if it doesn't, I've learned something and I'll try the next thing. Right. And to just iterate in that way.
Yeah, it's like we have more answers about what not to do in a hybrid setup that would be like a failure. But then what to do is everybody's learning because it's very weird to work in that setting. We had a bunch of people from on the podcast from hybrid companies that have been doing this for years. We're going to have HubSpot. We had Elastic. And, you know, it's interesting to see that everyone, what they're doing and what works usually for those who are going hybrid is how going with a remote first fashion, like what you're saying, where you're trying to do a baseline where everybody's equitable and creating an equitable work experience. So I think that there are like ways to do hybrid well, but at the same time, it really depends of the company, as you say. Like if you have 200 years, it doesn't really work to just apply
your culture, your values, like there's so many sort of high impact things that we can't, the dials that we can't touch and turn, but culture and values and diversity and inclusion is going to make a massive difference, right? Like the type of people that you employ is going to make a massive difference to how you think about this. And so I'm confident we can experiment our way through it. But if we, you know, it reminds me of back in the day when, you know, the banks decided they were going to go agile and they all wanted to go and visit Spotify. And I'm like, why? Like, you're nothing like Spotify. Not that Spotify is bad, but you don't do music streaming, right? And you've not got Daniel as your CEO and you're not, like, nothing about your bank is like Spotify. So what is it you are hoping to learn versus going, how can we be the best version of the bank and the most adaptable, nimble version of the bank to delight our customers? That's a great question to answer. I'm just not sure you're going to get the answer to that question by looking at how Spotify do squads, right? And I think we get carried away with the poster child without going, what can we learn from our own experience and learn from other experiences, but build a version of this that works for us, for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I think there's also this kind of need to be hype in the workplace, to follow a bit of the hype, the agile. And now it's like, okay, everybody's remote. If I want to gather talent, I need to do that. I need to talk about flexibility. I need to talk about all of this to attract talent. And they try to imitate what others are doing without necessarily thinking about, okay, what does it mean in our organization? Yes.
Yeah, and I think where that comes to be trickier, we did some recent research. We did this return on action report where we were looking, like, talking to employees, not Atlassian employees of companies all over the world, to understand, like, what are they experiencing right now? And what was fascinating was that over 50% of people we surveyed said they would consider changing jobs to get more access to remote work, right? And you're like, that makes sense to you, makes sense to me. The number of senior leaders I'm chatting to who are like, we need everyone back in the office. And you're like, time out, pause. The people you want to hire, that you want to do amazing work, they're telling you loud and clear they want access to remote work. And so if you say the word flexibility, but then you don't follow through on that authentically, you will lose those people. And most senior leaders I talk to tell me that one of their biggest concerns is the war for talent, right? But they're not listening to that talent, right? So, you know, we ran a fun experiment actually internally, something that your listeners can do. We shipped a play recently in our team playbook called the Work Life Impact Play. So we had this belief that, you know, we're trying to find ways of working with our teams, but we're like, how do we know we're doing the right thing? Now, we can't personalize our ways of working to every individual at Atlassian. That doesn't work. And nor can we build a singular Atlassian way of working, because that doesn't feel very inclusive. So we're like, cool, let's solve for the team. So this play, which any leader can do for free, says, what's the work from home situation for each team member? What's the nature of their network, their social network and their work network? And what's the nature of their role? Like, there's a lot of people I work with where their role is very individually focused. They can work in isolation and be fine. Others are highly reliant on team members to be effective. And we all map ourselves on those three things, your home situation, your network, and your role. And then we talk about it. So after you go and you say, right, I'm working from home and I've got a dedicated home office. However, I've got three children at home. And so I've got care responsibilities. You're like, cool. Like, how does that impact you? And you're like, well, I work for the company before we went remote, so I've got all these interpersonal relationships. And I could turn around and say, well, I'm new. I've only ever met another employee through Zoom, and I don't feel that well connected. And once we share, we all get an understanding for each other's situation. We then adapt our ways of working to that situation. So in Sydney right now, we're in lockdown. A lot of my Sydney colleagues are homeschooling, right? Because the schools are closed. And so I'm like, cool, now I understand that. How can we adapt our ways of working so you still feel like you can contribute? So one of my colleagues, Eugene's like, him and his wife, both full-time workers, and they've got two kids. So they've done a deal. He works the morning and looks after the kids in the afternoon, and they swap at lunchtime. They high five, have lunch together, and they swap. So I'm like, cool, let's do all the synchronous stuff we need where we need to collaborate in person or online. Let's do that in the morning. And then in the afternoon, I'm not going to book any meetings for you. Like, you can work asynchronously, you catch up, and we've reduced his hours a bit, but I'm like, I'm not going to demand 8 hours from you, because that would be pointless. You're going to do a really bad 8 hours. And so how can we start to tweak and build that understanding? And when we rolled that out to our leaders, the number of our leaders and frontline managers that replied with going, oh, I've been wanting to have that conversation and I had no idea where to start. All we gave them was a simple framework and a simple step one, step two, step three. and it's built empathy, and it's built vulnerability and understanding. Things that we crave. And you know what? To build empathy, you don't need to read a book on empathy, right? You just need to demonstrate it. You need to role model it and practice it. And for our leaders, and you know, we've got a lot of engineers, a lot of very sort of high IQ leaders that aren't always comfortable having these, maybe what we would class as touchy-feely conversations. Give them a framework. Work-life impact play. Work through it. And that's just been a massive amplifier for us in making those conversations more comfortable and then taking the action to drive the improvement afterwards, which I think as employees is what we're looking for. I don't want a leader to say, I care about my people. I want a leader to demonstrate that they care about their people.
And going back to that return report, right? Return on action report that you did at Atlassian. There was one thing that was really interesting is that it said 60% of the workforce were preferred to turn down a promotion to promote their own well-being.
Yes.
And I thought it was super interesting. I'd love to hear a bit more what you think about that.
Yeah, so let me, I mean, your listeners and you already know how I can only speak in honest isms, right? So my first reaction was, oh, wow. I've been giving out promotions to people because that's what I thought they wanted, right? For years, as a leader, as a manager, I'm like, oh, Daphne's doing a good job. She's working pretty hard. She's delivering results. I know what's in my artillery. I'll treat Daphne to a promotion. And you're there going, no, like, leave me alone. Like I'm fine where I am. And it's funny how, you know, in many ways, I'm only 43. I don't know if that makes me young or old, but I'm 43. That makes me old enough to think that I come from a generation where promotion was a badge of honor, right? Where promotion meant you were doing well. And I think there's a generation in the workforce now that's like, maybe promotion is, but it's not just promotion. It's not status. I want to have meaningful work. I want to have balance with my work and the other things in life, with my family and community and society and the planet and other personal pursuits. And this idea that, I think for maybe even the generation before me and my parents, is this generation where you were just working, you were just living and working. Like it just became this thing and it's symbiotic. It's like, actually, there's a whole generation now that they're happy to do their work, but they're doing it to fund their life. And their life might be traveling or blogging or storytelling or cooking or whatever it is. And so how do we understand the needs and desires of people? And how do we understand what is becoming, and you mentioned the word epidemic before, a pressing problem for us, which is mental health and wellness. And this idea that we're going to stretch people and promote them, it might be the worst solution versus having a conversation with that person going, where are you at right now in your career? What works well for you? And having that conversation.
What if people would want to be promoted and have better positions, better salaries and things like that, but these positions are actually not cater to be able to have a good work-life balance or have a good mental health? Why are these higher position more likely to be less attractive mentally?
Well, I think that comes down to kind of org design and job design, right? I think, you know, for I look at the way we do this in Atlassian, like we do a great job of nurturing our people before a promotion to say, how do we get you ready for that promotion? Then are you ready? And what does it mean to be ready? And then once you get the promotion, like acknowledge with them, you're probably going to be really average at this job on day one because you've not been doing it before. So how do we help you go from average to awesome? And what does that look like? And for everyone I've worked with in my entire time at Atlassian, which is many, many people, everyone's journey is unique. Everyone needs a different bit of development. Everyone's got a different background and history and different set of experience. And so we personalize that journey to them, right? For some people, it's like, I feel technically great in my new role, but I need help with stakeholder engagement. I've never dealt with those senior leaders before. Or I now realize I'm going to be presenting to a larger group and I'm not a great presenter. Help me with that. And you're like, cool, I can help you with that. I can put you on a course, put you in contact with the right people, give you mentoring, coaching, and do that personalization because I want you to thrive, right? What happens in a lot of organizations is if you want more money or more status, the only way to achieve that is promotion. So you put your hand up going, I don't want this, but it's the only way I can be acknowledged or feel relevant or motivated.
Or have more money. Or like, you know, if you want to like, if it's just a case, people work, they need to make money as well. Yeah.
You know? And so you look at that and you're like, well, that's my only choice. And so we've got many paths in our organization, which are individual contributors, where you're not managing a team and there's probably little chance for promotion, but it's like, what's the role and how do you add value? That's a very different conversation to what a lot of organizations, which is the pyramid, right? They've built the organization chart that says, Daphne, if you want to earn a good salary, you need to be leading a team of 10. Those 10 need to be leading a 10. Your total department needs to be 1,000 people. And you're like, is that the only way I can add value in this pyramid scheme? Or can I add value by being more creative or innovative or finding new ways of solving customer problems? Like, they're really valuable things to solve that aren't about a hierarchy. They're about the value you add and stuff.
Hey there, just taking a few seconds to mention our sponsor, Remotive.io, who is an awesome supporter for this podcast. Since 2014, Remotive is helping top distributed companies hire remote workers. Going remote has opened your company to the world, so going Remotive will channel your jobs to the best talents out there. You like the podcast so far? You can now subscribe and visit our new website, remotefirst.fm, where you can find all links, show notes, and resources for each episode. And if you found value in this show, we'd love your rating on your listening app of choice. And now, let's get back to the show.
I think the narrative is changing, and I think there's a couple of generations coming through the ranks that are just savvy, right? They're savvy to what's going on around the world. They consume news and politics. They're connected. They've you know, up until the last 18 months, normally quite well traveled, right? And so you're like, how do we take these people that want rounded experiences and help them in a workplace where, for a lot of our people, internal mobility, the chance to change role and build a new craft is more appealing than climbing some weird corporate ladder? And you're like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. You know, I was working recently with an engineer who wanted to become a product manager. I'm like, awesome. Like, where are you at? Like, let's look at the product manager roles. How, what does that mean? Is it a sideways step, a backward step? What are the gaps? How do we help you learn? And he's probably 9 months into that role now and loving it. But the thing he's loving is the growth, right? He's been stretched in a good way. He's been supported and pushed. We've got a great mentor for him. He's going on courses to learn the fundamentals of product management. And he's a great baseline product manager, but he's learning a huge amount. When you see him in a meeting or a presentation, you can feel the energy, the enthusiasm, right? And that's not because he's logged onto his bank account and gone, oh, I got paid today. Because we all know that the smile that you get from your paycheck landing doesn't actually last that long, right? If you want to be engaged and motivated, there's more to it in life. And I think that there's a generation who are asking for that more, and that more includes mental health, right? Includes that balance and readiness.
Yeah, it's like, what's the cost of mental health? In the end, why are you working all the day if in the end you're going to go finish, close the laptop and just be like miserable?
Well, Daphne, let me show you quickly. So part of my work-life education was with a big four consulting firm, so with Deloitte, right? And in my time at Deloitte, there's so many partners that I used to work with, and they would work every hour, God sent, every hour. And they'd work and they would earn great money and then retire at 60, right? And you're like, okay, you've earned amazing money. You've not traveled anywhere other than for work. You've not traveled anywhere. You've got not great relationships. Your kids have grown up and probably don't know who you are. Like it's almost like life passed you by, but you've got a great bank account. And so my argument is, I want a healthy bank account, but I also want a healthy family account, right? Which isn't measured by money. It's measured by relationships. And I want a healthy planet account. Like, are we doing this in a sustainable, scalable way so we still have a world to live, right? There's so many other accounts that aren't monetary. And I think we get obsessed by the monetary one. And I think that's sometimes to our detriment.
Yeah, this actually reminds me of the productivity or a happiness score that you,
yes,
you did, because you're actually like describing it slowly. I'd love you to explain a little bit more, because you spoke about that and how you actually need to see happiness in different ways in your life and four different factors.
Yeah, so the very quick context, I had a pretty average 2020 in terms of my own personal health, and my sister, who was also my best friend, passing away from breast cancer. And I had this moment in isolation in quarantine when I returned to Australia, and I was like where do we find happiness from? Like, I've had a couple of really rough experiences and I want to be happy. Like, how do we discover that? And I'd done a little bit of reading, and I just had this realization that we've over-indexed on things like productivity and profit. And if you look at the last 18 months, that's become more true. If you're onto LinkedIn on any given day or Harvard Business Review, there's a load of articles about productivity and then the odd one on wellness. I'm like, we need to flip those. I want more on wellness and less on productivity. And so I'm like, how do we work this out? And so I came to this conclusion that actually there was four measures of happiness when combined. So one is productivity and profit. The other one is people, your family, your relationships, your society, community. Like, who are the people that you connect with that you have a meaningful impact on in life? And how do you build authentic relationships with them? And the third one is the planet. How do we live on this planet in a way that we leave it in a better state than we arrived here on? Which I don't think many of us can say we do, and I struggle to sometimes. And then the final one is purpose, right? What's the purpose? What's the legacy we want to leave behind? What's the impact we want to have on the world? And then how do we rate ourselves on those four things? And if we're struggling in an area, what are we going to do about it? Not what do we want someone else to do, but what can I do? What can we do? And that for me was a great empowering moment to go, there's a whole load of externalities that may or may not make me happy in life. And I could spend 24 hours a day looking at the things that I can't do, right? It's very easy, but I'm going to be anxious and depressed and I don't want that. So I'm like, okay, what can I do? What are the two or three things that I can do? And I'm like, I'm going to take control. Like, I've had a miserable 6 months, but I'm taking control of my destiny and I own my happiness. And thinking that, I'm like, right. And so I started to take actions. One of the things I was worried about was my health and my impact on the planet. And so I went from eating meat probably two or three times a day, virtually every day of the week. And now I eat meat once a week, right? I'm not making everyone watch Game Changers and forcing plant-based food down anyone's throat. I'm just eating a more sort of vegan or vegetarian-based diet, and I'm loving it. My energy's through the roof. My skin's good. I'm sleeping. And I'm like, cool, that's fine. No one else has to do that. I'm fine. Like, if you don't want to do that, I'm not going to push it on anyone. But that's worked for me. You know, on the people side, you know, I actually narrowed down my relationships. I realized that I had like what felt like hundreds and hundreds of friends. But I'm like, which ones are the close friends? And in the time of the pandemic, I'm like, who are the people that I'm going to look out for and who also might look out for me? And how can I get closer to them? So actually, I shrunk my friendship group and a few people went to the periphery. And we're still friends, but it's incidental versus the ones that are like the super close friends that I can have more meaningful conversations with. And so just making these tweaks in my life to make myself happier. And then every 6 months or so, I re-review myself. Like, where am I at? Like, and I score myself. And if I'm struggling in an area, I'll take an action to improve it. So it's part of it's about ownership and the other part is about balance. And I think one of the things that I'm hearing as a narrative out in the world right now is there's a lot of people who are seeking balance and don't know how to seek it. For me, one way of doing it was to give myself some scores and go, I score badly there and I'm going to rebalance it. That's on me.
That works best for you, you know, having a score, a chart, yeah. You know, where you are at.
That's it.
I think it's a good tool. I think in the past year, almost two now, it's been the main issue. It's been work-life balance, trying to figure out how we're going to do that, how we're going to be able to like work from home at the same time as all the rest of their life. People have been very conscious about that. Mm. And it's this topic of well-being. I think it's probably why now in the study that you made, you are seeing much more people saying like, hey, well-being is much more important than job because they've been having it a bit in their face, you know?
Yeah, I also think like if we look at it objectively, we've also blurred the lines massively, right? I think for a lot of people, there was this like, I'm a parent in the morning and I'm asleep and then I feed my children and then I put on this superhero cape, which is my suit for work, and I travel into work and I'm a different person for 8 hours. And I do that and then I travel back and I return to being a parent. There was a really nice delineation between work and the other things in life. And what we've done now is put all those things in this melting pot of 24 hours a day in the same home. And it's quite confusing. As an identity, it's quite confusing. I've worn Atlassian t-shirts for the 8 years I work at Atlassian, but even I've got more casual in what I wear for work, right? And so that lack of separation, whilst it can be an advantage, and we've talked before about how you can use that to personalize your day or your week and make it work for you, it can also be a downside of going, am I working right now or am I at home? And I feel I literally have my laptop in a separate room and I very firmly close the door at night. And once I close that door, I'm done. I might check my phone once or twice, but I'm not in work mode because I need that discipline of splitting my mind, right? To say, I'm now in relaxation mode. I'm going to hang out with my girlfriend. We can have a conversation, have a glass of wine, have some dinner and not think about work. But I think for a lot of people, and certainly I've got huge empathy for people with children at home, where also for the kids, they're like, oh, mommy and daddy are home. That means it's playtime. You're like, no, mummy's working right now. And you're like, no, you're not. You're at home. And you're like, no, I am, but I've got a job to do. And mummy does this thing where she stares at Zoom all day and shouts down a microphone. And so you can't explain that to some kids. And it's not fair for them. And so I think that the constraints of the world right now are quite confusing, and that lack of identity can be hard. So that pushes wellness up even higher as an authentic conversation every leader should be having with their people. Even if you think they're fine, every leader should be having that. Because I think this is something we need to prevent and not cure. And my fear is we're going to wait for things to go wrong and then say, how do we fix them? We don't want to do that with mental health.
Right? Yeah, put meditation online again.
We can here's an employee access program that you can call up if you're feeling depressed. You're like, how about instead of me feeling anxious and depressed, we managed my workload in a way so I didn't get anxious or depressed. That would be a better outcome. And so I think we need to sort of shift our focal area. And when we do that, I think we'll see amazing results in terms of staff loyalty, staff engagement, because they'll actually be able to do the best work of their life because they'll be present and focused and energized. That's what we want. So let's not stretch them and burn them out. I met a great author, Huggy Rao, Hege Vera Rao from Stanford. He's a great organizational psychologist. And he said, we should treat people like books that you get from a library. When you take a book from a library, you have to return the book in the same state that you took it in. He said, why don't we think about people like that? My job as a leader is to return you to your family at the end of the day in the same state that you arrived in. Not burnt out, exhausted and frazzled, but the same person. I'm like, it's a weird analogy, but it makes sense. Like, how do I return you in a good or better state? Because if I'm taking all your energy in that day, that's not cool. That's not a life anyone wants to lead.
Mm. Well, thank you. I feel like I've been wanting to ask you like what kind of advice you would have for leaders and things, and I feel like you actually just keep going and give me more and more advice. So that's amazing. Thank you for doing it and sharing all your thoughts there. I think it's been amazing to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. And I will share along to the audience all the links and reference that you've been saying in the podcast with the report. And also, I think there was another one as well. Everything is going to be in the show notes. So thank you so much for joining, Tom.
No worries. Nice, and Daphne, thank you for organizing these conversations, because I think you've got an audience out there who is craving these pragmatic ideas of how to do stuff better. So thank you to you and your team for putting this stuff out there, because it's very valuable.
Thank you for tuning in to Remote First. You can find all links and show notes in the episode description. And if you found value in this show, we'd love your rating on your listening app of choice.